Welcome back, friends of Trek Movie. This is our second installment of the Shuttle Pod, the Trek Movie Podcast. We're very excited this time. We will be joined by the third member of the Trek Movie Triumvirate. My name is Jared Whitley. I've been a writer with Trek Movie for 2 years. Exciting opportunity. I'm glad to be able to connect with our friends of the internet in this way. I'd like to introduce my two co-hosts, Brian.
Hello. Nice to see everybody.
And of course, Kayla.
Hi, that's me.
Welcome. Welcome, friends. Okay, so we had some great input on our first one, which was a debate conversation between Brian and me about the merits of Star Trek The Motion Picture compared to the TOS episode, The Changeling. Today, we're going to be speaking to a much broader subject, a more open-ended. I hope you enjoy it. It's on how well has Star Trek The Next Generation aged? There's no particular milestone this year for TNG the way there is with Voyager, but I think TNG is certainly the most commercially successful and most well-known individual installment of the Trek franchise, and so we wanted to talk about its impact and its legacy. And one of the things that struck me a few years ago is there was a cover story on Entertainment Weekly about the 25 best things in sci-fi in the last 25 years. And I remember looking at the cover and immediately thinking, well, number one has got to be TNG, but it wasn't. I think number eight was TNG, and then the number one spot was The Matrix, which, of course, was very commercially successful. And then number two was Battlestar Galactica, which I think was still in the air at the time. And we're not here to debate the merits of either of those two franchises, but what we do want to do is talk about TNG's legacy. Why was it so popular in the late 80s and the early 90s, and how well has it survived today? Now, one thing that I say to people and kind of make myself a bit of an evangelist in this regard is there's a lot of talk about how we're in the golden age of television with dramas like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and a lot of others like that that are very popular and very intelligent and tell this long story and have really well-developed characters. But honestly, if someone were to ask me what's the best TV drama ever, I have to say Star Trek The Next Generation. I just have to. And it's not perfect, but if you take, like, bottom third of TNG, the middle third of TNG, and then like the best third of TNG, even those top two thirds are phenomenal. And I think they have aged extremely well. So let's open it up. Brian, if you want to start off, how well do you think TNG has aged in general? And then then Kayla, take a turn, and then we'll drill down into some specific aspects of this.
I think the show is... It's kind of a mixed bag. I think the show in some ways has aged very well, and in certain ways it betrays not only its age, but Gene Roddenberry's sensibilities in the mid-80s. As you and I discussed elsewhere, Jared, I think when I watched the Blu-rays the past couple of years as they've been coming out, I've been watching season by season, one thing that struck me is that, and this has been well documented over the years, that TNG... Gene's reticence about having conflict amongst the Enterprise crew really does hurt it in some instances. When you get into like the fifth and sixth seasons of the show, when TNG basically became what TNG is, the show is remarkably safe. There's, you know, everybody's just groovy with each other all the time, kind of. One episode after the other, it eventually gives it kind of a bland vibe at times.
Okay, sure.
But that being said, visually, the Enterprise, I mean, the certain interior parts of the Enterprise kind of look a little bit like a hotel. But
totally.
But the design of the Enterprise D still holds up and could be used today. You know, look, shows like these are ultimately products of the era they're made in, so, and some will hold up better than others. I guess I have to say, I mean, we can explore other parts of this topic in more depth, but let's put it this way, it's not as dated as TOS.
It's also not as old as TOS, but...
That's true. That's true. Kayla, do you want to say something?
Yeah, so I think, in general, I agree with pretty much everything you're saying. I think that it is a mixed bag, that there are aspects of Next Generation that are quite dated and very much make it a product of the late 80s and early 90s, particularly with things like set dressing, costuming, hair and makeup. But I think in the technology, which is something I'd like to talk about later when we get into more specifics, but I think one of the most important things about the show, which is its message, has aged incredibly well, as has TOS. And probably TNG has aged better than TOS has. TOS had a lot of sort of mishaps when it came to certain things in the message. And
Such as that episode where Kirk says that Starfleet forbids women from being captain.
yeah, I still try to rationalize that in my mind by like thinking maybe it was like misconstrued, but no, it's hard to get around that one. There's several things like that in TOS.
We'd seen an episode a few weeks earlier where the Romulans have a female captain.
Well,
So this evil empire is more progressive than Starfleet.
right?
I know. I when she, I always got the impression from that when she says this world of starships doesn't allow you. I to me, I always viewed what I think I forget exactly what she says, but it's something along the lines of, "Your world of starships doesn't allow women." I always felt that kind of meant he just was not going to have any kind of a relationship.
Oh, you mean Kirk's personal world?
Yeah, that's the way I always read it. I never read it the
Oh,
other
I
way.
see. I thought that it meant that it wasn't a rule in Starfleet that they couldn't be captains, but that there were still a lot of hurdles for women to overcome, which I think, if you take it that way, it still dates it because we should have progressed beyond that by
Oh,
then.
absolutely.
Yeah.
But you have to concede to the fact that it's almost half a century ago.
Sorry.
Yeah. But since we're talking about the Next Generation.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's segue into the characters. I think that's probably the most material we have there is to discuss the different characters, specifically to that point that you were saying, Brian, about the lack of conflict and sort of
Yes.
the overall gentleness of all the characters' relationships and the fact that there's no kind of really very many collisions. And when there's a problem that's introduced, where there's conflict, it's usually from someone outside. For example, there's this episode, and it's probably in the bottom of my middle third of episodes in terms of quality. It's an episode called Silicon Avatar, where we meet the crystalline entity, which has killed a lot of human beings, right? And there's this debate about is it really murdering or is it just feeding the way a sperm whale feeds on little fish as it swims through the Atlantic Ocean or whatever is the analogy that Picard gives. And the person who argues that point with him is not one of his crew. It's someone from outside of the crew. So that's just an example that comes to my mind. But Brian, this is something you've given a lot of thought to in terms of you use the word blandness of the characters. Would you like to speak more to that?
Not so much the blandness of the characters, it's just that the drama suffers when there's virtually no arguments going on. I'll give you a good example of like where this is where TOS really excelled. There's a second season episode called Bread and Circuses, and in it there was like a very raw exchange between Spock and McCoy, and while they're trapped in a jail cell together wondering what happened to Kirk, where McCoy kind of goes after Spock in the sense that he thinks that Spock doesn't really care whether he lives or dies in the particular scenario they're in, because every moment that he lives and keeps going, his perfect Vulcan veneer might slip and we might see who he really is. And the look that Spock gives him after he tells him that kind of just shows this incredible tension between the two that you don't see even that often in the original series, and you never, ever, very rarely ever see in TNG. So I felt like, there are certain instances where there were tense moments, like what was it, The Enemy, that episode, The Enemy,
Oh, yeah, where Worf won't give
where
donate blood. Yeah.
won't donate blood to the Romulan who needs it, but he and Picard have a very unpleasant meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one particular moment between the crew where, it's interesting and it's dramatic and it's very tense. And the other person who I thought that was very interesting, who unfortunately only lasted a season, and I know this is not going to be a popular opinion, but Pulaski.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. As soon as you said this is going to be an unpopular opinion.
Look, I'm not going to lie to you. When the show first ran, I did not like her. I thought she was Dr. McCoy in a skirt, basically. Yeah.
I don't even think she's McCoy in a skirt, because I think she's more than just abrasive. She's like downright mean to people. Like she would refer to Data, which is his name, as Data, and call him It. It was already just sort of rude, but calling him Data, it's like, that's not his name. Like,
it's very passive aggressive. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just mean. And it's like, I feel like that's not appropriate behavior for someone who is in any kind of chain of command. And I just, I'm just saying, like, I found her beyond abrasive. I found her actually disrespectful.
Yeah. And there's an episode, it's one of my very favorite episodes. I think it's the, unremarked gem of the second season. It's called Peak Performance. It's like the second to last episode of the season two. And she has this scene where she comes in and she's talking to Picard about how he needs to go give Data a pep talk when Data's concerned about how he's not working. And at that point, they kind of figured out how to make her work, mm-hmm. but it took her the entire season to figure that out about her.
Yeah.
How she could, I mean, she'd be gutsy enough to come in and say this to the captain, but in a way that also showed empathy. And
yeah.
She cared. And it's like, so she was delivering the bad news that she needed to. But it, you know, at that point it was too late. At that point they'd already decided they were getting rid of her.
Yeah, I agree. They could have made that character work, but I think that they did too much against her in the beginning.
It is interesting when I rewatch the show, how what an outlier the character really is. She's mm-hmm. almost like I agree with you. She's very abrasive, but she's almost like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I agree that, like, you know, every character doesn't have to be likable. And I think that's what I'm kind of taking away from what you're saying here is that for me, I find characters very interesting when they are severely flawed. And a lot of the most popular characters of all time, take like Joss Whedon, for example. Joss Whedon is really famous for writing very flawed characters. Mm-hmm. And that's something you never see in Star Trek. Especially in the Next Generation, like you're saying, it's very bland and everyone's always kind of groovy and happy with everything, which I think serves TNG as well as is perhaps a detriment. So I think on the one hand, the characters are often seen as much less three-dimensional than they otherwise could be. But at the same time, I sort of appreciate, at least looking at TNG from today, from you know, modern perspective, being 2015. Today, so many of the shows that we watch are all about, you know, the anti-hero and really harp on the flaws of those characters, which is very interesting. But at the same time, like, I kind of get tired of watching shows where there's not a single character that I actually, like, is a good person.
Sure,
and,
absolutely.
And so, one of the great things about TNG for me is it's like, same with the older Superman movies and the Superman shows, like, Lois and Clark and those other shows, is that it is this very happy thing and everyone is good and you like all of the people and you could be like any of them. And it's just sort of this like ideal. And I think that's a really Roddenberry thing. It's like have the characters be so idealistic that his whole vision of the future was that it's going to be this perfect utopian type society, which is sometimes a bit much, but at the same time, I can also appreciate it.
See, I don't think it's so much about the characters have to be deeply flawed. The characters just have to disagree about something, anything.
Yeah, because good people can want positive outcomes and have different ideas for how to get it.
That's
to
true.
To get to that point. Like, there's this great scene in the 2009 reboot where Spock and Kirk are arguing about what to do. And on the if you listen to the DVD commentary, which, of course, I have, J.J. Abrams is saying both of what these characters are arguing for is right, mm-hmm. right? But they just disagree.
Okay.
And so I think in response to this relatively long-held criticism of the TNG characters, that's something that J.J. Abrams tried to key into to make sure he didn't repeat that mistake by making it too peachy keen. The one example that I think of, and I know I've showed this to Brian before, of where the characters disagree, but they come to a stupid resolution, is in the episode Disaster, which is one of my favorite episodes, where all the characters are in a fish out of water type of situation, where like Data has his head removed and Picard is stuck with these kids, and then Troy is in command of the ship. And Ensign Ro comes in and she says, We need to separate the saucer section from the drive section because the engine is gonna explode, and if it explodes with just the drive section, it'll kill 200 people. But if it explodes with the saucer section attacked, it'll kill 1,000 people. And that is a perfectly reasonable suggestion to make in a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Troy says, we're not going to abandon our crewmates. And it's like, okay, great. That's exactly that phenomenon of two good people who are ethical. They're our heroes, but they have different priorities, both of which are reasonable. And it's a great episode. It's wonderful for Troy. It's wonderful for Rose. It's wonderful for Picard with the kids singing Frère Jacques. But then at the end, after it's resolved, there's this really like tender apology scene between Ro and Troy where she's like, oh, I was wrong. Oh, you could have very well been right. All this kind of stuff. And I think if that episode were made in the modern day, there wouldn't be that apology at the end. I think Ro just would have walked away and not resolved it. I don't think Troy would have gloated necessarily, but maybe she would have been a little cocky about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Troy as the character was used to being put in the background a lot. And here's a chance where she gets put in the captain's chair and she has a tough call and she makes the right call. So that's an example where they pushed as much as they could. And at the end, they put a Band-Aid on it,
mm-hmm.
or a lot of Band-Aids, and they didn't feel they need to.
And they tried to reset everything. They even have, at the very end of that episode, they have Troy saying to Riker, he says something about, oh, you can't stay away from the big chair, can you? And she's like, oh, I don't think I'm cut out to be captain or something like this. Like, it's sort of resetting everything. Yeah.
Mm. So. Yeah, I do think, to touch on that, if TNG were made today, the two characters who are a little more flawed, were a little more interesting, who I think would have been elevated from supporting cast to main cast, would be the Ensign Ro character.
Rolaren, definitely.
And Barclay. I think those are the two characters that are the most, to me, are the, after Picard, I would say, I think are the most interesting.
I wonder how much you could develop Barclay, though, because he's sort of, like, his flaws are a comic relief in TNG, like his fear of being transported and all this stuff. I mean, he's sort of made fun of throughout the show.
I know, but I think...
I love him. He's adorable, but...
He's very milquetoast, but a lot of it is also like, well, what are they going to come up with next? And then the one where he... it's not a well-beloved episode. It's called Genesis, where he gets turned into a spider, and he's in there, and he's talking to Crusher, and Gates McFadden is the most tragically underused resource in all of Trek history. She's just... Every scene she's in is so good. She can do angry. She can do funny.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome.
She's terrific, and they just, especially in the movies, they just left her on the sideline. But anyway, she's sitting there talking to Barclay, and she's indulging him or whatever. She's answering all these detailed medical questions. And then as he's walking out the door, she turns to him and says, Lieutenant, do me a favor and stay away from the medical database. And it's like, so of course Barclay would be a little bit of a hypochondriac.
Totally.
And that's kind of prescient. Like now with WebMD or whatever, we have
people
who self-diagnose. And so I think in a lot of ways with the proliferation of nerd culture in 2015, I think Barclay would be even more appropriate because there's his type of person, you know, the nerdy computer guy is more prevalent in society. I mean, the number one comedy on TV is the Big Bang Theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate the Big Bang Theory, but I think you could take that kind of character and do him really well. And, you know, they brought him back on Voyager and he worked really well too. He's
mm-hmm.
got that awesome cameo in First Contact.
So he's super likable.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Completely likable. Anyway, I don't want to beat a dead horse. Brian, what do you think about either of those characters?
I love Ro. The moment she came on the show, I love that character because she simply doesn't buy into all the grooviness going on around her.
Mm-hmm.
She's got her own issues, and you get her, you get to watch her try to work through those issues. And she does to some degree through her time on the series. She is definitely my favorite of the supporting characters. I was always thrilled whenever a new episode would come on and I'd see that she was actually going to be in it.
Yeah, the beginning of the sixth and seventh seasons, like I remember paying particular attention in the series opener of each of those to watch the intro to see if she'd been added to the main cast. And I was disappointed both times when she wasn't.
Well, Michelle Forbes did not want to be part of that.
I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It would have been great, though. It probably would have pushed one of the cast members out, but...
Well, but she was brought in to replace Wesley, so I don't think it necessarily would have pushed anyone out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. She was kind of the Wesley replacement.
Yeah. Kayla, how do you think how do you think the Troy character would be different if TNG were on the air today?
Oh, I think she'd be different in a lot of ways. First of all, her hair. Importantly, let's not forget about the hair and the costumes. We would no longer have the turquoise one-piece dress / tights thing going on, or the soul glow hair that we love from seasons one and two. No, but seriously, I think she would be a much stronger character as far as her ambitions and her ideas of self-worth. Because I think, I mean, a lot of times, like I said, how she's like, oh, I don't think I'm cut out to be captain. And later in the series, they do a much better job with her and Beverly, and just the women in the show in general. And Rolaren was a
Yeah.
great introduction. But
Yeah, there's an
especially.
episode called Thine Own Self where Data is on the A story is Data on the planet having some kind of weird data adventure where he's lost his memory. And then the B story is Troy going through these commander simulations to try to
Yes.
get promotion.
Yep.
And the B storyline with Troy is so much better than the A story with Data on the planet.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I remember most about those episodes is her going through the command training and the scenarios where she has to make like she has to do a no-win scenario kind of a thing.
Sure,
And
yeah.
she finally shows like some ambition and some yeah, she feels like she's useful and she can grow as a person rather than just like, I'm happy hanging out in the background and not really ever contributing much of anything. So,
Well,
oh, sorry. No, go ahead, Ryan.
no, I mean, I'm going to steal from Ron Moore here because he has been asked this question several times about TNG, and he felt that the thing that dates TNG the most is the fact that there was a psychologist standing on the bridge. Not the character of Deanna Troi, by the way, just that the fact that,
Because
maybe
she was on the
psychologist.
bridge.
No, because if you put a psychologist as, sitting next to the captain, he said that was a very 80s kind of a mindset.
Yeah, it was.
Huh. Interesting.
That no, not he had nothing, no problem with the character and or having a psychologist aboard the ship. It's just the notion of having
She
a
was sort of,
psychologist
she
sitting
was,
next to the
yeah.
captain and the first
Yeah, it
officer
was the
was kind
captain,
of
the first officer, and her. She was the third chair, as if
right.
her importance was that high in the ship. And
Right,
certainly her
which
rank wasn't, so.
right.
Yeah.
But no, I liked the character, and I thought that was a whole of the original series was not. I mean, McCoy kind of functioned as the ship's counselor, but
Yeah.
like,
Sure. And in fact, in the early episodes, they say he's got a specialty in space psychology or something like that.
right. But it makes sense, especially on a ship as immense as the Enterprise D, to have an entire department. I mean, she probably ran an entire department.
Oh, but yeah, well, they never say that at all.
No, they
No, I'm
never
sure
hint at
it
that,
makes sense.
but
Yeah,
yeah.
she can't be the only psychologist on a ship over a
No.
thousand people.
Yeah. One thing that I think was a wasted opportunity with the Troi character is the fact that we don't really see her, except when she's maybe counseling the captain on like a command decision to make. We don't really see her working with patients as much, and certainly not patients in the main crew. And something that, and it's probably been done elsewhere, but I think something that was really remarkable with The Sopranos. The HBO show is you got all this character exposition by having Tony Soprano go to therapy, right, and talk about his issues. And I think that's something they could have done with a psychologist, or excuse me, psychiatrist type character is a way for us to learn more about the crewmates.
Yeah, I like that.
It seems like, I mean, the way that they decided to teach us about the inner desires of the crew was, and they did it in TOS as well. Is they had everyone get the Psi-2000 virus where they basically get drunk and they just stammer around and like that's how they show like they're so stolid in their normal life that they only a disease can break them down to their id
And make them
and
take showers with their clothes on.
exactly, which you should never do. That's the defining lesson of Star Trek.
Although TNG did that too. They had the exact, they did a sequel to that episode right at the beginning of the
Oh,
first season.
yep.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. And there is
Yeah,
even a
they.
line that Riker really, hangs a lantern on it when he says something like, can you look this up in the database? All I can remember is something about someone taking a shower in his or her clothing. It's like, why would you remember this detail? And then, okay, whatever.
Yeah, to tie that up, that was an unfortunate second outing for the TNG crew.
Yeah, there were a lot of unfortunate things about that first year.
I kind of
Yeah.
like that they did that they used the TOS episode and it was an homage to that. Like, I didn't have a problem with that, but yeah, I do to see what you're saying about the concept in general.
Yeah. There's a my favorite episode that I love to use. I use the word evangelize again. That I love to evangelize about for the first season is the episode with the Bynars and with Minuet. It's called 11001001. I think it's a fantastic
It
episode.
is.
So do I.
And I think it's exactly what they wanted to showcase in all these characters in the first season. And again, it comes like, toward the last third of the season, so it's almost on their way out. And I wish that had been like the second episode because that would have set the tone for everything. Because we've got Geordi teaching Data how to paint. which shows Data's exploration of humanity and Geordi's empathy for his friend, who other people just see as a machine. We've got Worf and Tasha Yar competing in this intership, like, you know, space judo game, Teresi squares. We never really learned how it works. And we've got Picard and Riker. We see the different way that they react to
Minuet. Yeah.
Minuet, who's just fantastic, right? And I love the episode where they bring Minuet back as a flashback, where it's Riker's fantasy. Because everybody had that, where they've got like one little experience in their life that they hold on to. And for him, for it to have been that program by the Bynars, who's just played by this amazing actress, was terrific. And there, even Wesley is used really well in that episode, because the Bynars are doing all this stuff, and he says, well, wait, why are they doing this? And Riker says, oh, it's just their duty, but thanks for keeping an eye open. And it's like everyone in the chain of command just says, well, okay, we're ordered to let the Bynars come do this. And so they do, but the kid, who's not in the chain of command and has nothing at stake, if he questions the orders, he's the one who does it. And, of course, it turns out to be right. So I thought that was a really good use of the Wesley character, too, there. Again, the Gates McFadden character, not used particularly well in that episode. She's just talking about, like, some kind of research she's trying to do, and then Riker kind of shoves her off. So, again, it's a recurring theme, unfortunately. But all the other characters come across really well in that episode. So the other episode, in terms of showing Brian, you mentioned Roddenberry's attitude toward evolution of humans and whatnot, that I think sticks in a lot of people's craw, is the episode The Bonding, which is actually the first episode written by Ron Moore, where and I the thing I love about this episode is it's all about the consequence of the events that happen to a red shirt, because the red shirt gets killed off screen at the very beginning, and then it's dealing with how does the crew react to her orphan son now. And Gene Roddenberry didn't like the story at first because he said, in the future, we'll have evolved beyond the need for grief.
And it's like, insane.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. At that point, like, you're detached from your humanity. If you're not going to mourn the death of a crewmate, or let alone your mother, you're completely detached from humanity.
Yeah. Can I also... go ahead.
Sorry, Kelly, go ahead. No, please.
I also wanted to bring up, when you say this, we would have evolved beyond our need for grief, there is actually a line that does make it into the show in the episode, what is it, Time's Arrow? Is that the one with...
the Mark Twain episode.
With the Mark Twain, yeah. So I think it's in part two when Mark Twain is aboard the Enterprise, and he's like Deanna is showing him around the ship, and they're like in the turbo lift having this conversation. Yeah. And she's trying to convince him like why the future is so great, because he's saying what I see doesn't look so great to me. And she's like, oh no, like we've like evolved, and we've moved past, we've gotten rid of, and she starts listing all these things that they've gotten rid of. It's like poverty, disease, and the final thing she lists is despair. Like, she says they have gotten rid of despair in the future. Oh, and I'm just like, what? That makes literally no sense. Why would you want to remove an emotion? That sounds like we're going backwards, not forwards.
Yeah.
Well, then the question is, how do they remove despair? Is it they put something in the water?
Right? And why would you want to?
Prozac? Wow. Kayla, way to...
That was good.
Free my esoteric moment.
Yeah, that's one of my like pet peeves. My like, if I could put a pin in one of the moments that I most hate about Next Generation, I think it's that line.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Huh. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. I'll have to rewatch that scene. I think the problem with that whole Time Zero that sequence is it came right after The Inner Light, which is universally regarded as one of the top five episodes of all in TNG. Mm-hmm. And I think retroactively you look at it and you say they should have just ended season five with The Inner Light, right? The image of Picard playing the Resican flute on the way out.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful.
A great way to end this series for 3 months while people went on hiatus. But instead they needed to do another two-parter.
A two-parter, yeah.
And it's not, I don't believe Hell is one of the better two-parters in Gene.
I like that episode, actually. But...
my God.
Yeah,
completely. I don't know how. Well, as evidenced that they couldn't.
Yeah.
Okay, there's another two-parter that I want to introduce. We talk about how the characters don't come into conflict as much, but they have to introduce a new element in order to do that. And one of my favorite instances of that is the episode, it's called Chain of Command. It's the Cardassian episode, and it's mainly remembered because we have David Warner as this brutal Cardassian, and Patrick Stewart doing this intense method acting for like being tortured for whoever knows how long, and you know that's of course very compelling drama, But to me, the part that I enjoy more is the B story with Riker coming into conflict with Captain Jellicoe, who's this very by-the-book guy who's got his own way of doing things and he wants to mess everything up. And, like, he's actually not terrible, right? I mean, it's not like he's ordering, you know, the top 10%, the lower 10% performing members of the crew to be shot out of the torpedo tube, right? He just has his own way of doing things.
And he makes Deanna wear a freaking uniform on the bridge.
Probably should have happened 5 years earlier.
Yeah, finally.
So again, that kind of decision is not terrible. He's not doing anything that's out of the ordinary. But Riker, who's this guy who really fancies himself and who always in the back of his mind says, I could have my own ship, but I choose to be on this more awesome ship. And who probably when he wakes up and he's shaving in the morning, he looks in the mirror and says, yeah, I saved the Federation's ass from the Borg, right? And his ego is through the roof. He's got a captain who he's really good friends with for whatever reason. He wants to stick with him. All of a sudden, he's got a captain who doesn't find him adorable.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to deal with that. And there's this awesome scene where he's like in his quarters playing the trombone and Jellicoe needs to come in to ask him for something. And the two are just, they're just at each other's throat, but they're trying to pretending to still be professional or whatever. And it's terrific. I think it's the kind of thing. It's a scene that it's season 6, and so it wouldn't have happened if Gene had still been alive.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I kind of feel weird praising it in that regard. But I think it's the kind of thing where if there'd been more of that from the beginning, people wouldn't be having the same kind of conversation that we're having right now.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I do remember them saying, this may be Ron Moore saying this again, I'm not sure, but something about since they couldn't get conflict within the crew, they would try to bring conflict from outside into the crew. And that's how they would liven things up. And that's bringing Jellicoe in and having him basically shake everything up was very refreshing.
Yeah. It was, it also kind of lets you see Starfleet is different from ship to ship. Not everything's exactly like a Picard's crew.
Although he had a terrible catchphrase.
Oh, wait, let me see if I can remember it. Get it done.
Get it done. Yeah, and you're like, no, dude, it's make it so. Come on.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that. But Janeway, I think her catchphrase was "Do it."
Was it?
Yeah.
She says "Do it" a lot.
Okay.
I think they may have abandoned that as the series proceeded.
Yeah, not every captain needs a catchphrase.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it doesn't always work.
No, you can't force things like that. It's like nicknames.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up something about. How the show has aged.
Yeah.
The lack of serialization of any kind.
Yeah.
It hurts it several times
during
the course of its run, most of the time revolving around Picard. Yeah, after Best of Both Worlds and Picard's been assimilated by the Borg and had this horribly invasive thing happen to him, you know, we get one episode afterwards, Family, where he goes back to France and, you know, bonds with his brother, and then all of a sudden he's back on the Enterprise in command. If that were a modern day TV show, they would have spent an entire season having Picard recover from being assimilated by the Borg.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but I don't know do you think that would have worked when it was airing in the 90s? Because TV wasn't like that in the 90s. It was always at the end of the episode. Yeah, at the end of the episode, you reset. That's just how it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. There were only a handful of shows back in those days that did stuff like that. And the other episode that stood out.
Actually, before you move on, I want to say I think they had to push to get that episode that where Picard dealing with his PTSD, basically. But I think they had to push to get that one in.
They did. Gene didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Which was crazy. It needed Rick Berman. They were like, no, let's move on. You know, we've covered this. Let's move back into, you know, a regular show.
You got to go to fight the monster of the week. And the thing is, like that episode, everyone remembers Best of Both Worlds and the fight with the Borg as Picard episodes, but they're actually Riker episodes. The thing that made that storyline a Picard story was how it was the coda with Family, because it's so good.
I love Family. Family is the episode that made me a huge fan of Picard's. I love that episode.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Also, only episode of TNG without Data in it.
What's that? Jeez, I didn't even notice that. Wow.
Cool factoid.
And then the episode right after was Brothers, where he plays not only Data, but Lore and Dr. Sung. And so that's why they gave him a pass on that, is because the next episode was so intense for him.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think it's the fact that it's mainly just a Picard episode with some Worf stuff thrown in and then a little bit of Wesley stuff too, is not bad at all.
Mm-hmm.
Although I also will say, talk about serialization. To me, the last few times I've watched episodes of TNG, I've been pleasantly surprised with how much continuity they do have in there. I mean, because there's more than not as much as there would be on something today, but more than you would expect from some show that started in the 80s.
That's true.
Agreed.
But like, especially like the Klingon Civil War, like they spend a year and a half building up to it, and then the Klingon Civil War is basically one or two fight scenes, and then it's over, and it all happens in between these two episodes. Instead, the entire fifth season should have been the Klingon Civil War.
Yeah.
Anyway, Brian, I feel like I interrupted you, and I apologize. You were saying you had
No.
another example?
No, so yeah, Chain of Command.
Oh,
Like,
okay, great. No.
Picard was brutally tortured, and
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
following week, hey, everything's just fine.
Yep. Yep.
No biggie, I took a pill, I'm feeling great.
Well, they eliminated despair, right?
Right. Yeah.
There's a Geordi episode like that too. The Mind's Eye, where he gets programmed through his visor to assassinate the Klingon
Oh yeah.
governor.
Is
Yeah,
it
and
is
it,
he programmed by Lursa and Bator? I remember that incorrectly.
that's Generations.
Yeah. He's
His visor.
Oh, of
Yeah.
course. Yeah. Okay. I'm mixing that up.
No, he gets programmed by Sela off camera in the first appearance by Sela. And at the end, there's this great scene. It kind of goes back to what I was saying before, where Troi is doing this therapy with him, and it's one of the rare instances where you see her dealing with the consequences of the episode and trying to help one of her crewmates. And he realizes that he's been brainwashed. And she says at the end, "Don't worry, Geordi, we'll put your memory back together. We'll get you healed." And then, that's it. And
Yeah.
you don't see any other
It's
mention made of that.
assumed to happen off screen, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the show didn't have to be constantly serialized, but it would have been nice once in a while to follow up on some of these more traumatic events that characters undergo.
Well, they could have touched on a lot of important issues that we never have really touched in Star Trek, like PTSD, which has been a
Yeah.
theme of a lot of shows in the
Sure.
last decade.
Yeah.
And I think it's been really powerful and helpful for a lot of people to see that, on television when, Star Trek has been afraid to touch it.
And it doesn't even have to be something traumatic like PTSD. It can be something as simple as a romantic relationship, because most people don't just go from fling to fling to fling to fling. Most people
Yeah.
like have relationships and get married and stuff like that. But in TNG, the only character who got married was O'Brien.
Right.
And Keiko, of course.
Right, and then later
Right.
Riker and Troy, but
Yeah, but that was at the very end, right?
Yeah.
Right as they're on their
Right.
way out. And also, it never made any sense to me that they finally get back together again in Insurrection, and then they wait 4 more years to get married. It's like, come on, what are you waiting for?
These are busy Starfleet officers, Jared.
I'm sure, but it's like they have to do a Betazoid wedding, right? And they're not getting any better looking either, right?
That's true.
Maybe they needed
Betazoid
4 years
fantasy
to go to
has
the
trouble,
gym.
right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, well, so we've talked a lot about the characters. Is there anything else anybody wants to say on that subject, or do we want to segue to the next topic?
I think I'd like to say a bit about like the technology in
Let's do it.
Next Gen and the costumes and the sets and sort of production value stuff.
Yes. Yeah. I've got. Okay, take it away.
So I think like if you're thinking about if this in the context of the question of not only how well has TNG aged, but what would it look like if it were a show that were made today? I think that's another way to look at the question. I think one of the biggest things you have to change, I mean, aside from the visual effects, which have already sort of been done with the remastered versions, which are fantastic, but are things like the technology that we see in the Next Generation. One of the
Yeah.
reasons TOS and TNG work so well is because they were really forward-thinking with the tech. Obviously, a lot of classic examples from TOS, like the flip cell phone and
Sure.
transporters and all of this
Yeah.
stuff. But in TNG, they did the same thing. They had this integrated computer user interface across the entire ship, which was networked. And this, although, I mean, that existed in the 80s and 90s, but the internet wasn't very big until, the middle of the show's run, I would say,
Yeah.
or even later. But things like, but the downfall of that on the other side is that like the LCARS, which is the name of that user interface for all of the Enterprise.
Library Computer Archive Retrieval System.
Yep. But
Yeah.
it, which was a great concept that, that was great, but looking at it with a modern lens, LCARS is a terrible UI. It's
Yeah, it
impossible to
is.
navigate. It's written in this horrible font. It's like Impact or something. So
Sorry, my computer.
it's really difficult to read. I mean, it looks great and it worked for the show, but like people have designed, iPad apps and things like that that use the LCARS interface, and it's horrible as an interface.
I haven't seen that.
And the pad is a good example of technology that worked well for TNG because it's like the iPad today. It was, you know, of looking at these really thin screens that were also, I don't actually know if the pads were touch screen. Actually, I don't think they were because they did have buttons on them. But it
Oh,
was,
yeah, they
were
did. They were.
they
Were
touch
they?
screen?
I'm pretty sure they were.
But it's this idea of having, I mean, whether they were or not, this idea of having, you know, like a something that's like a pad of paper, but it's a computer. But it, you know, they to do that today, you know, the fact that they have that technology on the ship from the 21st century, I think dates it. Because while it was great for the 90s, and it was like, oh wow, they're really forward thinking in this aspect. You know, it wouldn't. That's not something that's exciting to see today,
Yeah.
because we already have that. So the fact
Sure.
that we've surpassed a lot of the technology
Yeah.
that TNG already has, would be an issue.
The one thing that, and sort of exactly along the lines of what you're saying, that I thought was very forward thinking is the fact that the controls weren't like buttons and knobs, but it was a modular touch screen.
That's true.
So if you needed to, like, you know, sometimes Geordi would come up to the bridge and he'd transfer engineering control there, and then the controls on the computer screen would change to adapt to it. For like 1988, that was incredible.
Yeah, for
Yeah.
sure. But again, for 1988, it was incredible.
Okay, sure. Yeah. The one bit of technology that they do, which, and it's an encounter Farpoint, so, you know, grain of salt with this one, that just really makes me roll my eyes and is ridiculous, is Riker's on the Enterprise D for the first time. And he bumps into some crew member and he says, "Can you point me to where Lieutenant Commander Data is?" He says, "Lieutenant Commander Data is in Holodeck 3." And she like taps something on the side computer panel where it'll be like a glowing ball of light that will like move to direct him to Data, right? Whereas nowadays, if you needed to find someone, you'd have like some sort of Uber system, right? Where you'd say like, "Where's Data?" "Oh, he's there." And you wouldn't need to use some little glowing light that was basically like an usher from an old-timey movie theater to show you where to find him. Anyway, I just think it was
They never
ridiculous to
use that
think of.
again.
Yeah,
No.
they didn't. I wonder if that was taken, inspiration taken from Ender's Game, which has the same kind of technology. I don't know if you've ever read it or seen the movie, but they have the same technology where to direct any of the kids in this battle school, they which is in space, they follow colored lights on the, I think on the floors that correspond to like whatever team they're with, so they can get to where they're going. So I wonder if that was taken from
Oh,
that.
maybe. Oh, I didn't know. I
Well,
mean, it's
that's
been a
very
long time
cool.
since I've read the book.
Yeah, just
But yeah, that
reminded
might have
me of
been where they
that.
took it from. The other thing that's kind of similar is whenever you hear an individual call for someone over the intercom. And I was watching yesterday's Enterprise a little while ago, and you'll hear like intercom messages where they'll say like so-and-so, report so-and-so. And it's like, why didn't you just pipe that through their communicator? Unless it's a general quarters type of thing where it's like red alert that affects everybody, why would you bug everybody with it? Why wouldn't you just send that message to Dr. Salar, whoever needs to be contacted?
So,
I mean, that's like the 24th century equivalent of hitting reply all on an email you don't need to.
but here's my question: does it actually go to everyone? Because, like, when we, unless maybe you have an example of when, like, we see that it does, but you know, when they tap their communicator thing, like if I'm going to say, you know, Kayla to Brian, and then I start talking and you can hear me, you know, the way that current technology would work is it wouldn't connect to Brian until after I said that. But
Yeah,
when they show the
that
scene
always bugged
from
me.
When they show the scene from Brian's point of view, he just hears blue, and he hears me saying Kayla to Brian, and then he hears
Yeah.
the whole conversation. So maybe
Yeah.
that is some magical 24th century technology where they can, like, it knows who you're gonna contact. I don't know how that would work, but
Yeah, I always thought of it that way too, Kayla, to be honest with you.
that it's just
I mean,
magical 24th century
some, yeah,
technology.
magical tech that we haven't invented yet,
Right,
you know.
yeah.
It seems like it would have made more sense still to say, Brian, this is Kayla, because as soon as you say Brian, it connects to him,
But then it
right?
would still hear me saying Brian, like if it were like the way that they do it currently,
Yeah.
which is weird because how does it know to send the message to him before I've even said it?
Yeah. It's like, I think there's an article in The Onion that says Google, and this is several years old now, where Google has developed a new technology that lets you send emails back in time.
Oh yeah, I think I saw that. I think Google did a April Fool's joke at one point that you could like predate your email messages so that if you wanted to get in on something first, you could set a t the timestamp to be earlier than it was actually set.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
Yeah, wow.
I think Gmail did that as an April Fool's Day joke one year.
Oh, okay. I know you can do that with like Blogspot or whatever. I think you can put up posts and say, oh yeah, I posted this a week ago.
Yeah, we can do that on Trek Movie. In fact, you can go and change the date of any of our articles and it will put it earlier in the future. Or earlier in the past, rather.
Oh, excellent. Well, of course, we don't need to do that because we're so good at scooping things like the name Star Trek Beyond.
Right?
Okay, so technology. Now the idea of the holodeck has kind of been talked to death, and I think mm-hmm. while it was clever in its inception, it kind of, a lot of holodeck episodes is going to go, went off the rails to the point where it seemed less like technology and more like magic. Like the episode, you know, the Moriarty episode, much as I love the Moriarty character and the actor who portrayed him, where Geordi just says, computer, create an adversary who's worthy of Data. And the computer just magically creates this artificial intelligence.
Yeah, who's self-aware.
Yeah. And it's like, the problem with that, and it got, this always kind of ground my gears with the Doctor character later on Voyager, is once you make it that easy to create artificial intelligence, it really cheapens the uniqueness of Data. Because it's always set up that he's so remarkable
right?
that we've had this... I'm sorry?
No, I'm agreeing. Yeah, right? I mean, because like he's this positronic thing and is so rare and, you know, so...
Yeah.
But if they seem to... The other thing is they seem to know pretty well how he works. Like Geordi has a pretty good understanding of like how his positronic brain works.
Sure.
So why...
Breaks, they fix them.
Yeah. And why do we only have one?
Yeah.
Well, one and a bunch of failed earlier attempts.
Yeah. And it's always established that he... they don't duplicate him for ethical reasons. But then it's like, well, how come we never encounter like a bunch of Romulan androids?
Right?
They wouldn't be ethical.
Yeah, totally.
Sorry. Anyway, I wanted to talk about the holodeck. Okay, if they were to do TNG nowadays and have some sort of holodeck-like technology, how might it be different based on what we know about the internet and artificial intelligence that we've mastered so far in the 21st century and virtual reality and so forth? How would the holodeck be different?
Oh, wow.
Hmm. I think, I don't know. I'd have to actually think about that one for quite a while because I think the holodeck is actually a pretty sufficiently advanced technology. I mean, how much more realistic can you get?
See, I think they wouldn't do the holodeck anywhere near as much as they did. And I think they'd be more realistic about programming it. Like when the one episode where they do a really good job of this is A Fistful of Datas, where, you know, they're on this holodeck adventure in the quote-unquote ancient West, and Worf says, you say Mr. Barclay helped you program this? And it lets you know, oh, there were people who actually had to plan this, and they had to come up with these ideas, and I don't know if he was individually writing code, or maybe there's some sort of holodeck template he was using, but it's not just he walked through a door and said, computer, magically make this all happen. It's that there were still programmers. I don't think we'll evolve beyond the need for developers. If anything, the more we advance in technology, the more developers we need.
Oh, sure. And I think they talk Absolutely. About that a lot is from what I can remember, is they would say, oh, I have this program to do this, or Worf has this training program that he made, or whatever. But I think, yeah, that's definitely important. You want, you know, a human person to be developing the characters because it's a story that you're, it's a way to experience a story. And so you definitely want, you know, a human programmer rather than just a random series of events.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something they did a better job with on Voyager and Deep Space Nine, where they'd say like when they have Vic Fontaine, they always make a big deal of saying, oh, Felix, and we never meet Felix, but we say Felix programmed Vic Fontaine, so they did have this, 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 and this. So it wasn't just, computer, create me a Vegas lounge singer worthy of singing to Dr. Bashir.
he still is magically self-aware, though.
Yes. And it's never really answered how he's self-aware.
Yeah.
He's special, they always say.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, the more of these artificial intelligence characters you make special, the less special it is.
Yeah.
So real quick, because I know we're kind of running out of time, and there's something that I just wanted to bring up, which was, if that's all right, which is
please.
The other, like, things that you see on screen, like the costumes, hair and makeup, and like someone mentioned at the beginning how the inside of the Enterprise kind of looks like a hotel.
Yeah,
I think, like, again, one of the first things you would change if you're making the show today is like the costumes. And there's a fantastic blog on Tumblr. If you haven't read it, I definitely recommend everyone go and read it. It's called Fashion It So. And so it's on Tumblr, and it's by this group of people who writes all about the fashion of Star Trek, and I think mostly the Next Generation. And it's just in this really sarcastic tone, and they pick up on things that I like never would have picked up on. So like the latest one they have is a season 5 episode, Imaginary Friend,
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
where yeah, there's this little girl on the ship who has like an imaginary friend, and it turns out the imaginary friend is actually this alien who's like trying to get her to do things, I think.
Yeah.
And they talk all about the costumes, and at one point they talk about how they notice that the little girl and her imaginary friend share the same kind of boots except for in a different color, and that they love how that seems like such a great little detail, because this little girl would have imagined her imaginary friend to have the same kind of boots as her. And so they go and they talk
Oh,
about
that's
it.
cute.
Yeah, and so it's like it's this really sarcastic take on it, and I just love the humor in it, because I think it's really spot on, and it really brings up a lot of the things that we were talking about why the show has aged. I think it's a great example of where it has aged.
Yeah,
And it's
I
just a
think
hilarious read, so.
I will have to check this out. And there's plenty of material on this too.
Yeah, tons.
Okay.
It'll be
Oh.
interesting to see, though, when they do finally come up with a new show, just how they're going to present the Starfleet uniforms.
Yeah.
They are almost a punchline to a lot of people,
Yeah, they look
space
like
pajamas and
pajamas.
that
Yeah.
kind of thing. Yeah, especially the TNG and like motion picture uniforms are very much look like pajamas.
The other thing along those lines that strikes me is when I see, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous for a military uniform where you're divided by these three different divisions and your shirt color is completely different because of that, right? And in TOS, because of all the campiness of the 60s, it doesn't feel that weird to me. But then in the 80s with the TNG actors, where they still have like one guy whose shirt is entirely red and one guy's shirt is entirely gold or whatever, where they're echoing what's been done earlier in the franchise, it really stands out and looks kind of dorky and out of place. And when they updated the uniforms in the movies in First Contact, I thought those uniforms looked great. And I thought that was something that I wish they'd been wearing all along.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised they did that with TNG because by the time you get into the Wrath of Khan, all those uniforms look identical.
Yeah,
It's
except
the
for
color.
slight
Yeah, except for
color
color.
accents.
Right, slight, but for the most part, they're pretty identical. The only way of identifying rank is through pins.
Some have different undershirt colors.
Yeah, like Command is white and Operations
They have
is
blue and yellow.
It's
yellow. McCoy had a green collar. Yeah, okay.
And so you'd think, well, that's what they eventually did with the TNG uniforms. Why didn't they do that with the TNG uniforms to begin with if that precedent had already been set in 1982 with Wrath of Khan?
Well, you know what? That doesn't bother me as much as what bothers me is when they like beam down to a planet and they know they're going to be in some kind of hostile situation. They have phasers drawn, and they're wearing bright red, bright yellow costumes, and they're like running around in the jungle, like hiding behind stuff. And it's like, Riker, everyone can see you. You're wearing bright red. Like, it just seems so silly. I think in Enterprise, I think they have like mission uniforms. Don't they have different colored stuff for when they go on away missions?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why it took them that long to do that. Like, it's like going to a desert planet. I'm going to wear this like polyester black and red thing. That makes sense.
And they never went to planets where it was like, I don't know, below 50 degrees, because like they never wear field jackets of any kind,
Yeah.
you know.
There's one
But
episode of Voyager where Kim and Chakotay like go rescue the ship when it's been crash landed on this ice
oh
planet.
yeah, at the very end.
Yeah, and so they're wearing let's call it Hoth gear in that episode, but
Yeah.
otherwise the TNG crew never did.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the one last thing that I wanted to say is in terms of how well it's aged. If you look at other shows from of the 90s, the big science fiction shows, the ones I think of are Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, of course. And I think all three of those, they looked at things that TNG said that were good, and they said, well, we'll keep the things that are good, but we'll change these deficiencies that the three of us have been discussing. And so in some ways, certainly Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine, and so I think those in some ways have aged better because they had TNG to learn from. But if you really think about it, the other contemporary sci-fi show to TNG was The X-Files, which has not aged at all well. I mean, you want to talk about the reset button and not having the kind of continuity that we would expect. X-Files is all about two guys and two agents, and one of them says, "I don't believe, I do believe," and then the one who does believe is proved right every single time. And I just don't think there's a fraction of the nostalgia for The X-Files that there is for TNG.
Mm-hmm. I agree with your opinions of TNG being the more effective program, but I wouldn't want to piss off too many of the X-Files fans out there.
I'm not trying to piss it off. I'm not trying to say anything bad.
No, I know.
I guess maybe I am. But like when the X-Files reboot movie came in 2008, nobody cared about it.
Yeah, I know. But there's all sorts of people worked up for the continuation that just wrapped. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll prove me wrong. Anyway, so all the X-Files fans out there, I love you all. But if you want to defile me online, I respect your right to do that. Okay, well, closing thoughts, Brian, Kayla?
Hey, Kayla.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'll just say kind of what I was saying before, to reiterate that, you know, if TNG were to be made today, not necessarily a new Star Trek show, but particularly TNG, you know, the things that you'd have to change are things like the technology involved would have to be a lot more forward-thinking. Obviously, things like costumes would have to be less sensitive to the time in which they were made, things like set dressings. And some aspects of the characters, I maybe don't have as harsh opinion of it as of the characters as you guys do, because like I said, I like a little bit of the fact that, oh, everyone's all groovy with everything, and they're best friends forever, yay. Like, I kind of like that a little bit about it, but I definitely would like also to have more conflict. Yeah. But in general, I think the thing that wouldn't change much is the core of what TNG is and what Star Trek is about, which is the message, which, as I've pointed out, does go off the rails sometimes. Roddenberry's message of, you know, we've eliminated despair gets to be a bit much. But in general, I think that the message really does resonate. And so the thing that's, and I think that's probably the most important part of the show and of its soul, if you will. So I think that in those terms, TNG has aged quite well with a lot of superficial things that would need to be updated.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The thing that I was reminded of when you said that is the obsession with zombies right now and the idea that people feel like the world is going to come to an end and zombies are going to come and eat our faces. And so I think the idea of a hopeful vision of the future is something that people need in order to combat the despair that they may feel from day to day. you know, we were maybe afraid of nuclear annihilation in the 60s or the 80s, but now there's more disparate things we're afraid of, and the zombie face is the one that we put on that. Mm-hmm. And so I absolutely think that core message is still just as valuable. And sorry, Brian and I were too hard on the characters. We do. And, of course, we love them. I'd love to go to have lunch with any of the characters from TNG.
Oh, absolutely.
I think we just sort of take the positive aspects of them as a foregone conclusion and then more.
Of course.
Right.
Some of the shortcomings. All right, well, that's it for our second installment of the Shuttle Pod. Thanks for everyone who made it to the end. If you have suggestions for things you'd like us to talk about in the future, please put them in the comment section or tweet us, at Trek Movie, and we'd love to continue this conversation with you. Thanks so much.